I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi and cantor Baruch Kohan, discussing his career in Hollywood, in film, and in television. In preparation for the TV to Torah event at Congregation Beit Simcha on Sunday, March 29th, we'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. This is the time of year when I typically start talking about the upcoming holiday of Passover here on 2 Jewish, which can occupy a full month of preparation, cleaning, and cooking before that great festival of freedom. But this year, everything is suddenly quite different. Our entire focus these days ranges from talking about the coronavirus pandemic to deep concern about the stock market to wondering at the latest coronavirus news. Daily life has changed dramatically. Travel and events and school and conferences and sporting events are all postponed or canceled. Everything seems to be up in the air right now, except travelers who are trying to avoid airline flights like, well, the plague. If you shorted cruise ship stock about a month ago, you are doing very well. Unlike the rest of us who've watched the market plummet out of fears of the profound disruption of the supply chain and general panic over the changes necessitated by this spreading illness. I have to say, the term going viral has become quite popular in recent years as internet stories and Instagram influencers and YouTube stars all sought that elusive viral video. I somehow think that will no longer be such a popular term in the coming weeks. At my own congregation, Beit Simcha, we held our Purim Carnival and crazy Megillah reading spectacle as planned last week, just with lots of hand sanitizer all around. But our multi-faith service, sponsored by 10 congregations here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, was canceled last week, and members of our synagogue board are beginning to debate whether we should even hold Shabbat services in, you know, live ones with people. We had them last Shabbat, and they went beautifully. We now cut challah instead of tearing it by hand, and latex gloves are available right next to the yarmulkes and prayer books, but it's getting weirder and weirder. The most valuable items on the internet are now surgical masks and hand sanitizer, neither of which has any intrinsic economic value to speak of. And finding toilet paper in Walmart or Costco or Target has become a true adventure. Bottled water is getting harder to find in some places, which is truly odd, since the coronavirus is not carried by tap water at all, so far as I know. And people are getting nervous about having to self-quarantine without basic supplies. You know, like 2 years' supply of toilet paper, I guess. I've even been told that out of desperation, people are now once again reading actual books. This is quite a remarkable development. I'm not sure what to attribute that to. After all, so far as I know, cable TV and internet services have not been impacted in the least, and the quantity of content available digitally, if not always the quality, is essentially unlimited. But there have been a number of accounts of people self-quarantining and taking actual paper books off of shelves and reading them for the first time in years. It's odd. The week after the Tucson Festival of Books here was canceled, lots of people started reading books anyway. Maybe it's a kind of desire to return to things we actually understand in a world that has become quite suddenly even more incomprehensible than usual. A virus that started in China has changed living patterns everywhere in the world. It is not the bubonic plague. It's not the end of creation as we know it. But perhaps it will encourage us to seek things that have more staying power and our usual pastimes and distractions, our daily news feeds and the transitory experiences offered by the nonstop flow of bits of information and images from our apps and phones. If you are so inclined, in this pandemic paranoia, I would encourage looking at one book in particular. It's called the Torah. It's been around as long as any useful book on the planet. It's a great read, and it has within it a wealth of wisdom and inspiration and humor and instruction that could occupy a person, self-quarantined or not, for, 30 or 40 or 50 years. Or you can read it in just a few days and then dig into the commentaries, and those, well, those last a lifetime. And it's available in book form, or on the internet at safaria.com, or through Amazon, or in any real bookshop, new or used, on this confused planet. To play us in this morning, from a text of Torah, is a beautiful setting called Katonti by Yonatan Rosel. It's about humility, but it's also a request to God for deliverance, first stated in this form by Jacob in Genesis, you know, in the Torah.
Katonti mikol ha-chasadim u'mikol ha-emet asher asita et avdecha. Katonti mikol ha-chasadim u'mikol ha-emet asher asita et avdecha. Katonti mikol ha-chasadim u'mikol
Katonti, from a text in Genesis. I am not worthy of all the mercies and all the truth which you have shown your servant. Deliver me, I pray you, God, deliver me. Deliver me, for your mercy towards me is great. A good prayer always, perhaps especially so right now. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Rabbi and cantor Baruch Kohan, will share stories about his time in Hollywood making films and television and the Jewish connections that shaped it all. Meet my dad when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our very special guest this morning. It is my father, Rabbi and cantor Baruch Kohan, who is the star of a new program coming up at Congregation Beit Simcha from TV to Torah, talking about his career in television and Hollywood. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
I'm glad to be here.
So you've been a guest here many times, although not for a while, talking about Jewish music, about Jewish themes, but I don't think ever talking very much about your career in motion picture television. Tell us how you ended up starting all that.
Well, I had my background was in Torah. Torah came way before TV.
Yeah, well, TV didn't exist when you started learning Torah.
That's right. But it was brand new when I got out of the Navy after World War II. I was discharged in 1946, and I really wanted to get into television. And a year later, I got into a car with a buddy of mine, and we traveled down the famous Route 66 all the way to Los Angeles. And he had a place to go that they thought they were preparing people for television. So I went there with him for a while.
What was that, the Pasadena Playhouse?
That's right.
The famous Pasadena Playhouse?
Yeah, the infamous Pasadena Playhouse. Of course, what they were really there for was to collect GI Bill tuition money. And after I figured that out, I changed my plans and moved to West L.A. With another friend of mine, Harry Cooper, Oliver Shalom, and we entered UCLA.
And so this was the motion picture television program at UCLA. Could not have been very old at that point.
Well, it was part of the theater arts department, and they didn't have a separate TV section, but they had a motion picture section. And that's where I got my background in film production, because they had a sound stage. They hired a fellow named Pat McDonald, who was a grip in the studios, to supervise it. And I eventually became a gaffer. A gaffer, you know, is the head electrician on the lighting crew. So I was up on the catwalk there a lot, moving lights around in very hot weather.
Well, and that was the beginning. When you finished getting your degree from UCLA in motion picture television, eventually you found your way into work in the TV studios.
No, in motion. Actually,
motion picture studios.
It was actually motion picture studios. It was made. The pictures were made for TV.
Uh huh. But they were
there
films.
There were videos at that time.
Right.
It had to be on film. So we produced films that were later shown on TV.
And we will explore some of that background and some of those films, which became famous shows like Cisco Kid and Sea Hunt, when we come back a little later this morning here on Two Jewish with Rabbi Baruch Kohan. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and especially Northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us this Friday night, 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our synagogue is west of La Cholla on the north side of Ina at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, not in the mall, but in our own building. For more information about Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and, of course, all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish community in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
The AIPAC conference always makes a big splash from Jewish media and in general. There were 18,000 attendees this year. AIPAC, of course, the pro-Israel organization, really a general lobbying group in favor of whatever they perceive the most important Israeli issues are. They had a number of speakers, including presidential candidates, representatives of the government, and so on, but they had some controversial speakers, and you want to talk about one of them in particular.
Right. One really upset me because the press coverage of this one particular speaker was that AIPAC's invitation to him and offering him a platform and a welcome proved Bernie Sanders right. And Bernie Sanders took a pretty controversial position when he said, I'm not going there because they give a platform to bigotry. Now, first of all, being critical of AIPAC is not the same as being critical of Israel.
Right.
AIPAC is not the government of Israel. It's not the people of Israel. It's an American organization that gathers together lots of people who love Israel, not necessarily in the same way, not necessarily from the same part of the U.S. political spectrum, and if they would be Israelis and have a right to vote, which most American Jews don't, let me remind your listeners, they would be all over the political spectrum as well.
You mean vote for the Knesset in Israel, for example.
Right, in Israeli elections, correct.
Right. Right.
Or, okay, so this year, AIPAC, for whatever unknown reason, invited the president of Serbia, whose name is Vucic. Vucic, in the past, was a minister of information during the massacre of Bosnian Muslims at Srebrenica in 1995. Mm. Now, 1995 is not ancient history. Vucic was younger then, but he's been in the government ever since, and he's obviously had a brilliant political career in Serbia because he wound up being president. And his only claim to virtue these days is he runs a corrupt country which is getting poorer every day, but he's warming up relations between Serbia and Israel. Well, I don't know how vital that is to Israel's well-being.
Right.
I don't even know how true it is or the extent to which he might be warming up those relations. But here's the thing. In my view, he's a war criminal. He's got blood on his hands. Why? Srebrenica, for the many Americans who won't remember this, was the biggest genocidal massacre in Europe on European soil since the Holocaust. And at least 9,000 Serbian men and boys were shot and Bosnian Muslim men and boys were shot and killed by Serbs on one day, and uncounted numbers of women and girls were raped and abused in many ways on the same day. Vucic defended this by saying something to the effect of, well, they had it coming, and for every Serb they kill, we're going to kill 10 of them, which is like a direct echo of Nazi attitudes toward Jews before they started deporting all the Jews to concentration camps, when they just rounded them up and put them into ghettos. If you resist, it's futile because we're going to kill even more of you. And it looks like we might have to continue next week, but I'm definitely not done with this topic.
No, clearly not. And that AIPAC invited him to speak is, well, we'll come back to that next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our shlicha on Israel, Inbal Shtivi, from the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Inbal.
Boker O.
Well, it has been kind of a crazy few weeks in the world with all the coronavirus information. Tell us how Israel is dealing with coronavirus issues.
So yeah, it has been quite a few weeks, I would say, generally, globally, and Israel is no different. At the moment, this is right now, we're talking about 75 people who are diagnosed with the virus, and tens of thousands are in quarantine, self-quarantine, people who have been in contact with those who were identified and now were asked to move into the house and never go out until at least 2 weeks.
Which for Israelis is like impossible.
Oh my God, it's impossible. I was just, my friends from Tel Aviv and other places are posting on Facebook what are they doing when they are self-insulated. They are, they practically, it's not, you're right. We cannot have it. We are an outdoor culture.
Houses aren't that big. People are used to social experience. They go to the market every day. Like, it's just, that's Israeli culture. Go to the cafe. It's like normal.
Right, especially in the big cities. You're very much outside. So now people are practicing online. They get yoga classes online.
Right.
They go through the entire Netflix selection. People are starting to read books or restarting, going back to books.
Wow, books.
Some people are quarantined while their kids are still going to school. Some people are separated. The kids stay with grandparents and they are at home. They cannot get out. It's quite a situation. The problem is, of course, is that the entire tourist market and actually the economy is suffering, I would say. So now I just learned that Airbnb apartments are now rented out as isolation places.
Wow.
So they're still making money.
Yeah. So the part of the economy that's still working is the Airbnb market.
Yes.
Ironically.
Airbnb is still there, yeah.
Yeah.
But hotels, places of bigger magnitude are taking a hit there.
No kidding.
Sure.
Wow. It's fascinating. I would say Israel has been as proactive as any nation on earth at quarantining people as soon as they came back from Europe. Nobody in the IDF can travel. You know, they've been really, really specific.
It has to do with the fact that there is a public health system. So
right.
Everybody goes to the doctor. And it has to be, and it has to do with the fact that no one wants it. No one wants to get the virus.
Of course.
And some brave decisions that were taken, I guess, that were taken by some decision makers.
Early on, I might add, you know.
Early on, yeah. The minute you see that such a thing is happening, and you, plus it takes into consideration several things. First of all, Israel is not such a big country, so you can actually better grasp, better control over, like, the number of people living there, right?
Right.
Is not 200 million. It's a completely different.
No, no. It's, 7.8 or 8 million, whatever it is, something like that.
9 million.
Yeah. 9 million, sorry. Okay.
So that's one. And second, the fact that there is a public health system that identifies and people are talking to each other, people are sharing, and people are doing whatever they need to do. No one wants to get the virus. And that's for sure. And, Another interesting development is that in Tel Aviv, at least, that's what I know, they created a Facebook group for those who lost their jobs out of this crisis, people from the tourism industry, and now they are, they're like, don't be bored, or while you're searching for, you know, for your future, you can volunteer for those in quarantine. You can deliver food, you can deliver groceries, you can deliver, you know, you can do a favor to someone.
Right, and that's such a part of Israeli culture anyway.
Everybody wants to help, and because it's really, and of course the jokes are hilarious.
Well, let's save them for next time.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks so much, Inbal. We'll talk next week.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's time now for our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. The week in presidential politics, like everything else, was dominated by coronavirus news. The Democratic debate, set to take place next week in Phoenix, was changed from a live audience and moved to Washington, D.C. It won't be a live audience. It'll be, you know, not a live audience out of fear of spreading infection. Honestly, that kind of debating is a bit more like the way actual debates are conducted in debate competitions and, frankly, in real life. Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are now the last two remaining serious contenders for the nomination. No apologies due to Tulsi Gabbard, who remains on the ballot but consistently ends up behind several candidates who've already pulled out. In any case, I think that a debate format without hot takes and audience oohs and ahs is probably better. And frankly, it's a much more Jewish one. While my experience of these things is mostly due to my sons both being state debate champions here in Arizona in high school, the Talmud is a long and elaborate system of debates with the intent of figuring out just what God wants of us in life and the best way to live. And there's no applause or cheering or any of that in the Talmud. A real presidential debate should focus on the best way for our country to do things, not on buzzy comments or insulting remarks or quick takes that gain immediate audience response. So as Biden and Sanders square off, Bernie Sanders, of course, is the sole Jewish candidate remaining in the race, I very much approve of the cleaner, more straightforward, more Jewish format. May the best man win, and all of that. And may everyone stay healthy. That was our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Izzy, a Polish-Jewish immigrant to England, has never been on a train in his whole life. One day, he decides that since it's a lovely sunny day, he'll try a train ride. Off he goes with his yarmulke on his head, a kosher salami under one arm, a black bread and some pickled herring in a jar in the other. He sits down in a plush compartment that he finds and settles down to eat lunch. Suddenly, a porter pops his head in and says, "Sir, you will have to leave this compartment immediately. It's reserved for the Archbishop of Canterbury." And Izzy replies, "Well, how do you know I'm not the Archbishop from Canterbury?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, even if you're not the Archbishop from Canterbury.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Daniel Levy. Boker Tov.
Boker Badlet.
So coronavirus is everywhere. Everybody's talking about it. And I guess there were a couple of Shin Shinim, just like you guys, who were in Milan, Italy. What was the story with them? What happened?
So we have three Shin Shinim in Milan, Italy. But because it's been really spreading out, like mainly like over there, it's been increasing. And so they were brought back home. And there were some concern about the other Shin Shinim, like about us, if we should be brought
them?
Back home.
Oh, from
yeah, yeah. If it's to be a reason to worry. So they're brought back home. They're in Israel. Not that it's too safe in Israel now, but
right.
But they're back home, and there's been a few like talkings and just like rumors about maybe bringing us back. I don't know about that, but
they're concerned. There's definitely a concern.
Yes.
I would think. Obviously, there's no Shin Shinim in China or
no
Iran.
Shin Shinim in China.
in terms of
Iran
country.
Yeah. A good idea.
Yeah, it's possible, but unlikely. I also, so there are some people who have been exposed to coronavirus in Israel. Is anybody actually ill with it, or just people that are exposed?
Yes, there are a few.
There are a few.
Yeah.
In the recent elections, there were some, tell us about what happened, because the people that were, some number of people have been quarantined within Israel, right? That means, is that basically house arrest? I mean, you stay there and you're sealed in your house. What did they do? But everybody in Israel votes. I mean, 70-some percent of the population voted in this third election. Yeah. Tell us about what they did for that.
So actually, they built a special kalpi, how do you say that?
I don't know, polling?
Yeah, polling
places. Yeah.
Place.
Yeah.
And they sealed it from all around, and they called the 5,000 people that were in isolation in their home to come and vote, because this is their right and they can prevent that from them. So
so I assume they like come by wearing masks or something, or gloves. What do you do?
By ambulances.
Oh, by ambulances.
Yeah,
okay.
And so the people in the ambulance.
Trained
personnel, right.
With,
of course.
Antiseptic or whatever it is they're using, right?
Yeah, something like that. And then they came inside the tent. It was like a tent or something, I don't know. And then they voted with the gloves. And they, after that, they washed their hands with alcohol. And it was really
pretty intense.
It was really funny and weird, but what can you do?
But yeah. They voted.
Yeah.
Just a kind of an aside, not so much about coronavirus, but when you guys voted, you actually flew to, where, to Los Angeles?
Los Angeles.
To the embassy there to vote?
Right.
Yes.
So when Israelis, you can't, you don't have to be in the country to vote.
No. You have to have you have to have an Israeli emissary. So it's like putting like more in big city, in big, yes.
It has to be an embassy.
Exactly,
before you can
an
do
Israeli
it,
embassy.
Right?
So it's, Jerusalem doesn't have one. Yeah,
right.
So like LA, New York, Chicago.
Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Right.
If you're like a tourist, you can't vote.
Yeah, you can't vote from Tucson, Arizona, for example.
Right.
Yeah,
or you can go to LA and vote because you're not an emissary or something.
Right, right. I see. So you have to have an official reason to be out of the country, and then you
citizens.
Can vote. Well, it's great for participation, and I certainly hope that the coronavirus, which has affected the Middle East, but really much more in places like Iran, remains very limited in Israel. Thanks so much, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week's double portion of Vayakhel Pkudei deals with the question of the creation and completion of the tabernacle in the wilderness, consecration of the first central worship sanctuary of the people of Israel. Vayakhel et ha'am, the text has it. Moses assembled the people, called them together, and asked them on God's behalf to bring forward the finest objects they possessed to create the tabernacle in which the whole people could worship God in holiness. And the people gave the best they had, gold and silver, precious stones, materials used to create a beautiful sanctuary, one they could be proud of, one which they believed would lend itself to the perpetuation of beauty and sanctity. Then Moses invited those artisans, wise in the ways of working with beautiful items, to come forward and create a structure embodying what God saw as appropriate for a sanctuary. In particular, Moses explained that God has called by name a man named Bezalel from the tribe of Judah, whom God filled with the Spirit of the Lord in wisdom, understanding, knowledge, all manner of skilled workmanship. He is filled with the wisdom of the heart, that he might teach and work with every wise-hearted person in this sacred work. When their work was complete, they had created a tabernacle into which God immediately brought the divine presence, a place of profound sacredness for our ancestors. I love that phrase for those skilled in the work of hands, wise-hearted men and women, who can create beauty and elegance to serve God in this world. Each of us possesses different skills. Some can sing, some can dance, some speak eloquently, and some of us create works of art and practical beauty with our hands. Each of us can contribute to the creation of holiness in this world by applying those skills to holy work. And when we do, we too have the potential to bring God's presence into our midst, into our ordinary, practical world, and so make it sacred. May we each use our own skills this week to make our lives and our world a little holier. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, will share stories of his time in Hollywood, making movies and TV shows, some of the stars he knew and worked with, and how it all led back to Torah. Find out when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In the midst of all the coronavirus stuff, Rome's Jewish community is now in a state of complete uncertainty amid Italy's coronavirus crisis. We are a proud and ancient community in the midst of the worst situation we have faced since World War II, said the president of Rome's Jewish community, Ruth Dergello. The Jewish agency is trying to assist Rome by preparing to deliver aid to Jewish communities all over Italy who are hard hit by the coronavirus. We are trying to stabilize the situation, but there is tremendous anxiety here about the danger of a complete collapse. Morale is very low. We know there is light at the end of the tunnel, but we don't know how long the tunnel is, Mr. Gello said. Italy has implemented a state of almost total lockdown, keeping only supermarkets and pharmacies open, asking people to stay home as much as possible. The containment measures are having tremendous effect on the country's Jews. There are about 30,000 of them in Italy. Many of those Jews have relatives in Israel, and they cannot see one another during this crisis. More than 12,000 cases of coronavirus have been recorded in Italy so far. Over 800 people have died. The Jewish agency is collaborating with the Italian community to identify and meet its needs to the extent it can. Chairman Isaac Herzog said that he has had emotional conversations with Jewish leaders in Italy. He's urging other Jewish organizations to figure out how to help Italian Jews. Italy's Jewish community is small and comprised of a relatively large number of elderly people who are encountering a challenge the likes of which they have not faced since the Holocaust, said Herzog. He added, "We've set up a special team to immediately analyze their urgent needs. We will work to help the community as quickly as possible. I urge our parallel Jewish organizations and Jewish communities worldwide to mobilize, given the extent of the need." In other coronavirus news, the Auschwitz Memorial and the site of the former Nazi camp are closed to visitors now due to concerns about the virus. The memorial announced last week it will be shut down until at least March 25th. That announcement comes on the heels of the decision by the Polish government closing all museums and cultural institutions, as well as schools and universities, in order to contain the spread of the coronavirus. Last month, Auschwitz called on organizers of trips to the site to refrain from bringing visitors from countries affected by the coronavirus, but earlier this week, the entire March of the Living was canceled. Last month, Israel's education minister, Rafi Peretz, had ordered the cancellation of all high school trips to Holocaust memorial sites in Poland due to the spread of coronavirus. Over 3,000 students had been set to travel to Poland in recent weeks. In Washington, D.C., the ADL released a guide to contemporary anti-Semitism for candidates running for national office. Anti-Semitism Uncovered, a guide to old myths in a new era, identifies the most persistent tropes about Jews, explains why they are dangerous, provides a backstory behind the myths, and shows how they have evolved to today. As violence against Jews is already at historic levels, we call on all public leaders, particularly during this heated political season, to avoid invoking anti-Semitic tropes, said ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt. These tropes that this guide explains, the roots of anti-Semitism, have led to violence against Jewish communities around the world for centuries. Today, they are still modern drivers of anti-Semitic violence, finding voice in the tweets and public statements of elected officials, or resonating with the extremists who carried out violent attacks against Jews in Pittsburgh, Poway, and Jersey City. Each chapter of the ADL guide addresses a well-known anti-Semitic trope, including the ones that Jews have too much power, are disloyal, killed Jesus, and, of course, used Christian blood in religious rituals like making matzah. Ugh. This guide also addresses Holocaust denial, anti-Zionism, and the delegitimization of Israel.
This is not murder. This is mitzvah.
The new Amazon Prime TV show, The Hunters, is making news. The premise is that a diverse team of American investigators worked together in New York City in 1977 to capture, mostly kill, escaped Nazis who were plotting to create the Fourth Reich. Starring Al Pacino and a number of Jewish actors, including Saul Rubinek, Logan Lerman, and Carol Kane, among others, the dramatization is very loosely based on famous Nazi hunters like Simon Wiesenthal, Beata Klarsfeld, and others. The controversy has come to the show because of the way the creator and showrunner David Weil, grandson of a survivor who developed the show as a testament to her, and the team of mostly Jewish writers fictionalized the Holocaust, inventing incidents and events. The Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum criticized the way that The Hunters invents things that never occurred and places them there in Auschwitz, and the way that Auschwitz was used as a setting for a fictional game of human chess, in which the Jewish prisoners used in the game were executed as their pieces were captured. It's a mostly well-made show, but clearly polarizing in how it depicts the Shoah. Follows last year's interesting and idiosyncratic Holocaust film, Jojo Rabbit, which won its writer-director star, Taika Waititi, also known as Taika Cohen, an Oscar, while also provoking quite different responses. Frankly, I think both Hunters and Jojo Rabbit are worth seeing and discussing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our very special guest this morning, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, who happens to be my father. Has spent, he's only 93 years young, but he spent his career in the early stages, although he began as a cantor when he was, I think, 17 years old. Went in the Navy, came out, went to UCLA for motion picture television, and then went to work in the movie studios making films for television in the 1950s. So tell us a little bit about some of the projects you worked on, and how did you get a job in the studios in those days?
Well, first of all, I got to tell you, the best thing I got out of UCLA, your mother.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah, she was in the theater arts department too, but she was in stage productions. And according to the rules of the department at that time, whatever your specialty was, whether it was stage or film or radio, you had to put in one student production on stage. That was required. And it so happened that a friend of mine was producing a one-act, an original one-act, which would not win any awards, but it was a major production, just two characters.
Uh-huh.
So I was the male lead, and there was a young lady who played the female lead, a very nice girl. She was too tall for me, but we had a... We had a stage manager who was a cute blonde from New Jersey by the name of Claire, and she and I spent a lot of time together because that had to be the most over-rehearsed one act in town. So we got well acquainted, and that was 1949, and sure enough, 1950, we got married.
Well, I'm certainly grateful for that, or I wouldn't be here today, and neither would Two Jewish, we might add. So, after you guys got married, settled in West LA, Santa Monica, how did you end up getting into the studios? Because that's never been an easy thing for anybody to do.
Well, it's so happened that my background in Cincinnati helped me get in there. How that happened was we went to a congregation in Cincinnati. The rabbi was a man named Samuel Wool. And he knew what I wanted, and he got in touch with a man who had been his student in his congregation, also a Cincinnatian, by the name of Unger, Babe Unger. His real name was Maurice, but everybody called him Babe. And so I finally got interviewed by Mr. Unger, and I told him that I had recommendations to him from other people. He said, "No, Rabbi Wall was enough."
So there had, isn't it amazing? Like a rabbinic recommendation got you into the studios.
That's right.
There were a few Jews in the movie business. There might still be a couple. So tell us about some of the projects you worked on and what it was like working in the studios in those days.
Oh, it was quite taxing. It was a six-day week. There was no Shabbos. It was impossible.
Right.
It was Monday through Saturday all day long. And, of course, you look at it, I think there are basically three kinds of work that we can do in our lives. We can work with things, we can work with people, or we can work with ideas. Mm. And the motion picture and television medium is one way to work with all three.
Yeah, that's right. That's fantastic. And it's a creative way of working. But it's also, I don't think people totally understand, but it's such a cooperative venture, you know.
Well, of course. For example, my first assignment at Ziv Television Productions was on a series called My Favorite Story. Mm-hmm. The host was a well-known actor named Adolphe Manjou, who was strictly the host. He didn't work in any scenes with anybody else, but the stories that he introduced were dramatizations of public domain short stories.
Okay.
Of course, they had to be public domain.
Because they were free.
Exactly.
You didn't have to pay the writer.
Yeah. Ziv was well known as a very low budget production company.
I see. All right.
So, I worked on that for a while. My first assignment was I had an office. And I had a desk, and agents used to come in and slap stacks of scripts on my desk they were submitting.
Right.
And I had to read them all and report on them all. And some of them were quite good. I mean, I read Rod Serling scripts, but they didn't fit into our format.
Yeah, they weren't your show's format, right?
Right. So I had to turn them down. And then I also had to go to the library.
So you turned down Rod Serling scripts.
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's something, Dad. I don't know. So yeah. Then you had to go to the library.
I had to go to the library and read these old short stories and see if I could pick out one or two that we could use.
Right.
Once in a while, got lucky and picked out one or two. And so that series wound up. And then I was assigned to one of the most famous westerns in the world, The Cisco Kid.
Oh, boy.
Starring Duncan Ronaldo as Cisco and Leo Carrillo as Pancho. Well, assignment to begin with was a story editor.
Okay.
Story editor means that you work with a writer. A screenwriter comes in. And you work with him to develop a script that'll fit the format of your series. And I wanted to do some writing myself, and once in a while I got a chance to do that. Also had a good writing partner there, but a lot older than I was, a man by the name of Barney Sarecki. We used to turn out these scripts together. Of course, we weren't making any huge amounts of money, understand?
Sorry, do you get more money for writing the script, or are you just...
Well, yeah, we got each script, a half-hour show,
right,
on the Cisco budget was worth $600.
Uh-huh.
And if we wrote it together, we had to split that.
$300.
Exactly.
Big money to be writers in Hollywood. Oh, my. Yeah.
Of course, since I was working for $75 a week...
That was pretty good.
That was good.
Yeah. So on the Cisco Kid, Leo Carrillo, actually quite a famous guy in Southern California from a famous family, an old California land grant family.
Yeah.
I remember you telling me a story about you were driving over into the San Fernando Valley going to visit you were doing some shooting out there. You were going to go to a location shoot, and Leo Carrillo turning to you and saying, "My family used to own all of this."
Yeah.
And it was true.
Yeah, he said, he also told me, and they sold it for 12 cents an acre.
12 cents an acre, yeah. Now, you also worked on Sea Hunt, right, with Lloyd Bridges?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, Lloyd Bridges, we called him Bud. He was really, in my recollection, I think, of all the performers and technicians and everybody that I worked with in the studios, Bud Bridges was the best human being.
Hmm.
He was really a mensch. When we started shooting Sea Hunt, we were going on location to Silver Springs, Florida. And I took your mother and your two sisters with me. We got a little place that we rented in a town near there, and go out on to Silver Springs to shoot the first day on location, right? And also, the series was still new. It hadn't come out in California yet, but it was a syndicated show, so it didn't come out the same place all over the country. But it had opened in New York. There were some tourists there from New York. And when they saw Bud Bridges, they mobbed him. And he wasn't ready for this, you know?
Yeah, he wasn't a star yet. That's kind of made him a star.
Yeah. It was quite an interesting experience.
And of course, he's the father of Beau Bridges and Jeff Bridges, very prominent actors who've gone on to great careers. And by all accounts, a family man, a good guy, just
very
a,
much
as you
so.
Said, a mensch.
Very much so. They lived not far from us in West L.A. when the kids were growing up. And it so happens that not long ago, I attended a stage play in L.A. The leading actress was a girl whose last name was Bridges.
Mm-hmm.
I walked in there. And, of course, Bud's no longer with us, but his wife, Dorothy, was in the audience. And I went and had a little conversation with her. And when the play closed, you know, the closing curtain, the cast went out to meet the audience because it was a small theater.
Small theater, yeah. Right, yeah.
And I remember going up to this girl and telling her, "You're grandfather would be proud of you." Oh, she loved that.
It's a great story. Look, I know that we could go on a great deal more, including talking about Gene Wilder and Mel Brooks and some of the other people you had the privilege of working with. If you want to hear more from Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, not only about this, but about his continual career back to Torah after TV and movies, come to From TV to Torah with Rabbi Baruch Kohan. Sunday, March 29th at Congregation Beit Simcha. You can find it at BeitSimchaTucson.org. Dad, thank you so much. It's been, of course, a great pleasure.
For me, too. And we'll talk a little bit on the 29th about Jews in Hollywood and how they react to their Jewish identity.
Indeed, a very interesting and much broader question. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be Professor Bart Ehrman, the best-selling New York Times author and scholar, discussing his new book, Heaven and Hell, A History of the Afterlife. Our playout this morning is by our guest, Rabbi Cantor Baruch Kohan. It's his own composition, We Wish You Love. Hear him in person at Congregation Beit Simcha, Sunday, March 29th at 6 p.m. here in Tucson. The program is called TV to Torah. Don't miss it. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up or call 276-5675. My friends, may you have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov and a week, we pray, of peace.
In the courtyard of Solomon's temple, watchmen tended the fire on the altar. Some by day, and some by night. When the day watch and the night watch met, they would greet each other with these four blessings. Ahava, Ayahva, Shalom, Ereheyo. Ahava, Ayahva, Shalom, Ereheyo. We wish you love, we wish you brotherhood. We wish you peace, we wish you friendship. Ahava, v'yachva, shalom, v'yachva.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.